Access number 31048, real one.
Ted Maladine, real one. I suppose if you start with a bit of background.
Okay. My father and his brother, I'll link that bit in because they were both members of the AFPU, were born and bred in the Bethnal Green area, brought up in a pub which my grandparents ran. It was called the King's Arms, but even only 10 years ago, it was still called Maladine's above the door, albeit it's in that little booklet I gave you, albeit spelt incorrectly, but people went round Maladine's. So they had, by Bethnal Green standards, a relatively good upbringing. My father married a girl, again from Bethnal Green, so the whole background, in 1931. They married. He went to Ardingly College, would have been during the First World War, left at 14, of course, as so many people did at that time, and we've since had something from Ardingly saying that he showed no academic ability, which we were fully aware of. And I know that when he left school, he told me he didn't know what he wanted to do at all. And at one stage, I'm not certain whether he had 9 jobs in 6 months or 6 jobs in 9 months, but either way, it was fairly rapid, I think. Errand boy, all sorts of things. He then was apprenticed into Fleet Street, into the darkrooms. How or why, I'm afraid I never answered the question. One should have done. There's so many things you should ask after the event.
Did your parents have any ambitions for him or his brother?
My grandparents? No, I don't think so. I think so many people, rather similar to some of your grandparents' background, everybody went to a good school and left school at 14.
Yes, I think your grandmother would have wanted him to be comfortable.
Yes, but she was sharp. We have a picture. He worked, I don't know where he worked, but certainly Topical Press is one that has been mentioned. Planet News is another one that's been mentioned. And certainly he worked for Associated Press, because he was working for Associated Press on his at the time of his honeymoon. It was the time of the Great Recession, came back to find he had a 10% pay reduction. Then sought other alternative employment and was appointed to the staff of the Daily Herald in May 1933. At the princely sum of 10 guineas per week, which was quite considerable in those days. Obviously, his work had attracted attention before being appointed to the Daily Herald. At that time, the Herald was the biggest circulation photographic paper, photojournal paper. And there's something in that booklet there about going to Paris and flying back from Paris with photographs of Foch's funeral, leaning out of the plane, handing the plates over to a dispatch rider. I mean, it's amazing when you think of it today. There we have a picture of the press at work in late 1920s, early 30s. There's my father there. That camera we still have at home. The box which carries the plates and the camera was strong enough to sit on, as you can see, or stand on to get elevation. But they're all wearing a hat. I find that absolutely amazing nowadays when you think about it. You see photographers in all sorts of fairly scruffy garbs. We've got here various pictures of the 30s. Now, this was from an exhibition called the 30s, and we bought these ones because I never saw very many of the my father's 30s photographs. One of his specialities was the use of light and dark, a shadow. And there we have the fishing fleet at Great Yarmouth, sometime in the 1930s. Obviously winter, obviously late afternoon, because you've got huge, great shadows there from the pedestrians. And he covered most things that went on in the 1930s. We've got letters here from senior people at the Herald complimenting him on the photographs for King George V's funeral in 1935. And you've got various things that were covered at that time, social events like Henley. It's not much different now. The fashions are slightly different, but not much. And race, silver bullet, Railton Cobb car coming back from breaking the world speed record in the 30s, and the famous picture of Chamberlain stepping out of his plane as he came back from Munich.
With the pictures that are more on the side of social commentary,
mm-hmm.
were they something that he would steer towards of his own accord, or was that more in line with what
it was the commission of the paper, you know, right, the king's dead, would photograph the king's funeral, or like this one here is of my father actually, which is at Ascot sometime in the 1930s. There's him struggling through the crowd, and that's very much a social commentary when you look at that picture. There's another social commentary here, which is when Edward the VIII abdicated and they went down to a villa outside Cannes before they got married. There is the paparazzi of the day sitting outside, all holding their cameras again. Notice nobody ever puts a camera down. They still keep holding them, sitting outside waiting for something to happen. That would have been 1936. One of the things my father did do was that he purchased a lens in a war surplus shop in Fleet Street, and it was reputed to have come out of a Zeppelin, and it had a 4-foot focal plane. He brought it home just after they were married, not two pennies to rub together to get an earful from my mother, and it sat in the wardrobe for 2 or 3 years gathering dust and earfuls from my mother fairly continuously, about a waste of money. And then he struck on the idea of making a 4-foot long camera, because it had a 4-foot focal plane with a 5-4 plate at the back, and this 4-foot long camera. It was known in Fleet Street as Long Tom, and that enabled a lot of close-up photography to take place when it couldn't take place. You look at all the pictures of cricket in the 20s, you'll see Hobbs doing a cover drive, and he's nowhere near the stumps, so there's no ball, and he's just sort of standing there. But of course, with the effect of this, you could actually do people doing the shot. The picture of the 1937 coronation, which is always the one that is published, is that's the picture. And that's taken off the Victoria Monument, perched on the top there. And that's always the picture that's published. It was in Hello magazine only last year or the year before the Queen's 80th birthday, the picture of the coronation in 1937. So from that point of view, he did establish himself as a very much different photographer, with a lot of sports photographs. In the 30s booklet, which we've let Hillary have, he is mentioned as a very much as a action photographer, and there are pictures of him. I know he went up a trapeze to allegedly take pictures of these trapeze artists who said they moved too fast to be photographed. I've never seen those pictures, but they must be something, because they were mentioned in this 1930s booklet. Whilst we're on Long Tom, and then I'll come off Long Tom after that, Long Tom was used in the 1953 coronation, and was used with colour photographs at that time. And my father had the latest technology with the wind-out lenses and all the rest of it, and I was in charge of Long Tom, he said, now, and that's my picture on the cover of Illustrated, because his picture, the sceptre, was right down the middle of the Queen's face, so this was the better one of the two. So that's okay. So we covered really pretty well the 20s and 30s, of which he covered an awful lot of social things. He was moving away from straight press, obviously, a lot of press, but covering stories, like lots of pictures of the hop pickers. He always used to do pictures of the harvest and things like that. And it was the texture and the form of a lot of his photographs. We went to this 30s exhibition, South Bank, in 1979, and some of the pictures I had never seen, but they were, you know, good sized pictures on the wall, and I could say from looking at them, that could be Dad's, that could be Dad's, by the just the form. And he had his own style. I couldn't describe it, but it is a very particular style. And one of the ones that... So he was working for an Odum's sort of sister publication called Weekly Illustrated, and then it became Illustrated. In 1936, 37, 38, they were doing both. You know, they go out and do something for Daily Herald and it would be published in Illustrated, so it worked like that. He was on the staff. And at the start of the war, there we have a photograph. There was a story run in Illustrated of how we were beating the U-boat, which of course took a long time. And here we have a very typical photograph of my father with Sunderland silhouetted behind the moon, behind the clouds, coming out of the clouds, which is a very typical photograph of my father's use of light and dark and form. And the lead picture on the story was Little Edward Gets His Plate Full, which of course is a picture of me having a full plate of food, which was the main theme of the story. We have here again, 1939, a picture of Lord Gort, who was Commander-in-Chief of the BEF, and Edmund Ironside, who was Chief of the Imperial General Staff. And again, if you look at that, I presume this was done for Illustrated because it says September 1939 on it. If you look at the use of light and dark, you've got the shadowing, which gives it a bit of depth and form. Another one of that time was Chancellor of the Exchequer, Kingsley Wood, but pretty immaterial really now in the story. He obviously went to France in 1940 because in his papers we found a safe conduct from the French government, allowing him from the 23rd of February to the 22nd of March 1940 to travel by air on Imperial Airways to France. He went to France in uniform, I believe, in about March 1940, because we have a picture here which is dated March 1940 of him and Leslie Davis, who was a photographer as well. They're all dressed up in jodhpurs, would you believe, and gas masks, like everybody was. And he came out of... At the time of Dunkirk, he came out through Boulogne, which fell before Dunkirk. And then they went back. there's a picture here of my father, Ronnie Noble, who was famous for the Korean War work for the BBC, and Len Putnam, who was another Fleet Street photographer and I know was in AFPU. And this was at the time when they went back with the second BEF. Very few people know that Churchill sent another 30,000 men back to Cherbourg in 1940. And they got as far as Le Mans, found more French people coming their way, turned around and came back out again through Saint-Malo. Okay. He went on various commando raids, and in fact, I'll just digress. When we last came here, and since we've interrogated your website, we've seen so many of my father's photographs of the Dunkirk evacuation from the Dover side, obviously after he'd come out of Boulogne, and we were evacuated to Salisbury after Dunkirk. And he was stationed down with Southern Command. And a lot of the pictures that you've got on your website are scenes of training activity, etc., taken in the latter part of 1940-41, when I remember being in and around the Salisbury area, such as I did. We went back to London I suppose it must have been the middle of 1941, I can't give you a date, but in the latter part of 1940, he went on the commando raid to Vagso. And he always told me the story of the covering fire from the cruisers, stopping just before Ramsdown and hearing the pipes of Major Jack Churchill, second in command of No. 3 Commando, standing on the top blowing his pipes and then handing them down to his batman, being given his claymore and going off to fight. I mean, that was a story he always told me. We have that picture as well, where they were doing the demonstration of priming grenades, and it went sadly wrong because somebody left a grenade primed and didn't put it on safety, and somebody shouted out, "Christ, that bugger's live." My father, not being particularly tall, ducked down behind the bloke in front of him, who was killed. In a narrow area, if you get a grenade go off, it's not very nice. Those were the pictures that mainly hit the press of Vargso. And somewhere at home we've got a Daily Express of early January, because remember, they hit Vargso somewhere around the 20th of December. And nothing got back into the press till well into January, by the time they'd trugged down in a cross-channel steamer, would you believe? It was a Belgian Railways cross-channel steamer. They went up to Vargso, north of the Arctic Circle. When you think about it, it's quite amazing, really. Those are the pictures that were in the press. You've got them all in your records. There's the ones of the chaps, I think, the luckiest chaps of Vargso. They were the German prisoners of war, who, had they not been captured, would have almost certainly gone to the Russian front, and probably would not have come back. They worked on land in England or Canada and survived. I'm not certain whether that one's going in or going out. That's coming out, certainly, because they got German hats on. Now, that tin hat, we had steps up to our front door, and I couldn't actually reach the knocker. I came back from school and I used to bang on the door. And the door was flung open by my father wearing a German tin hat going, "Heil Hitler," at me. Well, I can still remember the fear of that. And we used that as a doorstop for very many years. Two pictures here, which... that one is more interest to me now than it was for very many years. That one before D-Day, they all did toughening up courses with PTIs and getting them fit for D-Day. And I think there's probably more AFPU personnel in there than I recognise. There's certainly Peter Hanford and my father. Others I don't know or recognise, but I guess that was an AFPU group that was there. That one I was looking at quite closely the other day, and it's Montgomery's headquarters staff and probably his divisional commanders, because it's got Percy Hobart there and it's got Dempsey and all the others and the Air Force people. So it's quite an interesting one, which one of these days I'll get my magnifying glass out and try and identify everybody on it. Just before D-Day, the troops were inspected by the good and the great, usually the King, Churchill, Montgomery on the British side, and Eisenhower, any visiting American politician, and Churchill, who tagged along for the ride sometimes, doing the American ones. Here we have Montgomery, who'd just been promoted to Field Marshal, walking with the King, and then the parade that took place. And they're all lined up for inspection by the King, and the King coming, walking down and talking to my father. They're not my father's photographs, obviously somebody else has taken them. Talking to the King. And obviously the King asked what his flashlight and all the rest of it was. Because you have to remember that royalty, coming from the 30s, was used to something called caps off in Fleet Street. Because flash bulbs, and it was flash powder in those days, were so slow burning, if they went to something like a premiere of something and there were 20 photographers there, all with flash pans, they'd never see anything for the rest of the night. So it was one photographer had the pan, and it was caps off, take cap off. He called caps off, and the cap would go back on again whilst the flash should have burnt away. There's a lovely story Dad used to tell of the Jubilee of George V, 1935, wishing to be photographed with all the field officers of the Brigade of Guards. So they're all sitting there, all lined up, some standing, some sitting, all the rest of it, all with their bearskins on, etc., etc. And one of the photographers does the usual, caps off, and all the Guards officers took their hats off, leaving George V rolling in the aisles because he'd heard it so often and it was part of his everyday life. Yeah, during the Normandy campaign, my father was called to Montgomery's headquarters. And when he got there, it was one of the visits that the King and Churchill were making. Montgomery, of course, never drunk or smoked, and in 1940 he had a little notice on his desk saying, "I neither drink nor smoke, and I'm 100% fit." Churchill looked at it apparently and harumphed. "Why drink and smoke, and I'm 200% fit?" And he never had any alcohol or allowed smoking in his headquarters. But the only time the table of booze appeared was when His Majesty came. My father walked into Montgomery's headquarters in Normandy and walked into one of the anti-rooms, anti-tents really, off the main headquarters, to find the King pouring himself a scotch, looking up and saying, "Oh, you caught me, haven't you?" Delightful sort of thing that any of us would say. I don't have very many of the Battle of Normandy, but I have two significant ones, the Battle of Normandy, which are the top and bottom of this page, which show my father and his brother in Normandy. And it's a very good description, when I do a description for visitors, of the devastation, what liberation did for the French. I think that one is Ogny-sur-Rodin, which more or less was taken out completely. And certainly, I've got other pictures in books of Ogny-sur-Rodin. It just disappeared. And that one, I think, is Villers-Bocage, which, again, changed hands four times, I think. So was well fought over, as you can see. These other pictures show the going through to Paris, the route through to Paris, through the Falaise Gap. I'm trying to find the site of that, but they've changed, which is a road marker. It says N182, but there's no N182 in France anymore. They've changed the number, so I'll try and find the location of that. And they went through on the AFP U2 jeeps to liberate Paris, of which we've got a whole wodge of photographs that you can see on the liberation of Paris. Bert Hardy was with them on the liberation of Paris. Big Charles de Gaulle arrived, was very rude to all the resistance leaders in his haughty manner. Went up the Champs-Élysées milking the applause, as he always did. Laid his wreath on the tomb of the unknown warrior. And then we have the first three British people saluting was my father, the film director, I've forgotten his name, gone, and somebody else. First British people to salute the tomb of the unknown warrior after the liberation of Paris. We then got, they went to High Mass at Notre Dame, and you can see the entrance to Notre Dame there. They're currently engaged cleaning those statues, and it looks totally different to what's on there, doesn't it? But as they got there, or as Big Charles arrived, somebody shouted that there were snipers in the Tower of Notre Dame, and everybody started shooting. And if you look at these photographs, you see they're obviously taken off the hip in the moment of panic. There are people trying to get cover from curbstones. There's two women under that tank. You can see only a pair of legs on one of them coming out. Of people, the absolute panic of everybody ducking for cover. And my father says that was the only time he ever fired his gun during the war, because he joined in with everybody else. And there we have de Gaulle arriving with Big Charles in his somewhat haughty manner, told them to go away and rule their part of France. He is here to do the main thing for them. He was bloody rude to them all. They'd suffered the whole time. But that was he, and he, moi, je suis la France. Here we have photographs of the battle to get us to the Rhine, and indeed in 1945, and that picture there has been published in a book, Second World War in Pictures, and it's on better paper, better printed, and it's come out of your archives. So, and it looks a totally different picture. It shows it was bloody cold, and the youth of the German prisoners of war. I mean, you get that sort of there. They are incredibly young, they really are. The other pictures I've got, the next ones we move into, is the German surrender to Montgomery. Hitler died, committed suicide at the end of April with the Russians just down the road, and appointed Dönitz as his successor. Dönitz had the sense to realise it was up, and arranged for his emissaries to meet at a certain place at a certain time with Montgomery's people. So they arrive in their car, are met by Churchill staff, and asked to be taken to Montgomery. They arrive outside Montgomery's headquarters, and you can see it's a grey, not very warm day, early May, and Montgomery leaves them standing outside for quite some time. And then when he does come out, and they come to the salute, he leaves them at the salute for quite some considerable time before he responds himself and they can come off the salute. The reason for that was he wanted to milk the photograph, because when the Germans went away to discuss something afterwards, he turned to my father and said, "Did you get a picture of them saluting under the Union flag?" "Yes, sir. I had it got put there for that purpose." So there he is. He asks to his interpreter, "What do these men want?" And they said they wanted to surrender all the German troops facing Montgomery. But of course, under the terms of the surrender, it had to include the Russians, and they didn't want to surrender their troops facing the Russians. Montgomery told them that there was no choice, that's what they had to do. So they went away into the woods to discuss it. Now, I like that picture because it really sort of shows, well, what do we do, Holly? You know, it really is quite a sorrowing scene from a German point of view. So they go away after that and come back a couple of a day later to do the deed and signing. Now, one of the pictures I like here are these of the Admiral Friedendorf and the other German emissaries shot through their Mercedes car, because you've got the picture of them silhouetted against this rather grim grey sky, with the framing of the inside of the car and the car door, which really adds, I mean, they don't look happy bunnies, as you can well understand, but it really adds a bit of drama to it. And then we have the pictures actually in the in Montgomery's tent, which Montgomery subsequently autographed for us in later years. I think it was 1949.
Did you say that your father was probably his favourite?
Yes, something we learnt doing these tours, we had some English people come over whose uncle, I think it had been, a relation, had been in the AFPU. Don't know the name, no. But he happened to say, "Oh, we're going over and we're going to do a tour and we're going to do it with somebody whose father was," because that's what we'd advertised. And he said, "Oh, Malindine, yes, Mally was Montgomery's favourite photographer. He always called for him when he wanted something." I just take that. And there we have the other German surrender, Army, Navy and Air Force, signing on behalf of the German High Command.
Was that for his photographic skills or just his character and personality that appeal?
I don't really know. I think for probably his character, I think both. I think you're right, Linda, but I think there's a range of portraits you've got of Montgomery, which are quite good of Montgomery in colour as well. And I think it was probably both. Montgomery, in my father's eyes, was always the blue-eyed boy. I knew him, that's not strictly speaking, but obviously when he was in Southern Command in Salisbury, Montgomery was down there at the time, Commander of Southern Command, and a lot of his photographs would have been dealing with the Montgomery scenario in 1940, so I think it rode on sort of the knowledge. There we have the German Dönitz, Speer and Jodl being taken into captivity in Flensburg, and then flown away to, they subsequently went to Nuremberg, of course, for debriefing. you've got them all. And we've got various pictures here which are of no great importance. There was a whole group of Army film and personnel, AFPU people there, with my father and his braces at the back. And I think that one at the back there is Jack Flack, who was a photographer that I've, name I've heard, and Peter Hanford, who my father used to speak very highly of. Peter Hanford, of course, was a sound recordist by profession. And my father said he was absolutely mad. He used to, when there was a barrage going on, he would drive out in the middle of nowhere to hear it going backwards and forwards and recording it backwards and forwards. And an awful lot of the subsequent war, post-war films had Peter Hanford's sound on them, which he'd sat in the middle of no man's land recording whilst it was going on. My father said he was nutter.